So I will start with a very simple slide from Louis Braille and Helen Keller. I guess you know both, but not everyone knows that Louis Braille got blinded by himself because he was a little too curious when he was 3 years old, and he injured his eye with one of those pin tools that later helped him to pin the Braille system. And interestingly, you know, the title of this book is The Boy Who Invented Books for the Blind. So you might know that when he was 11 years old, he got a lecture. This is 19th century. He had a lecture because the military were trying to convey information in the dark at night. Okay, and so they were trying to invent a process where you could transmit message in the dark. Okay, and it was rather primitive, but it got his imagination triggered. And of course, he was super motivated by the issue. So when he was 15, he solved it. Okay, so this is just one slide to show that, you know, if you really want, if you're really motivated, you can contribute a lot to very important things. And so that's true for a learner, in that case, a very young one. But it's also true for a teacher. And Helen Keller's teacher, as you all know, had the patience to help Helen. But part of Helen's progress were thanks to Louis, because of course at some point she used the Braille technique. Okay, and in fact, 100 years after his death, there was a ceremony in France where he was moved to the Panthéon, you know, the place which is the most honorific one in France, and she was there, and she gave a lecture in the Sorbonne, thanking him. Okay, so there is quite a nice little story here where, you know, a learner, especially motivated and innovating, can contribute not only to his own learning, but to everybody else that has a similar issue. Okay? And so for me, and of course they were on two different continents initially. So the conference we just organized in Paris in the Pasteur Institute was another pioneer trying to invent biomedical research in this case. So I don't know why we don't have a Louis Braille Institute for educational research, but I guess maybe it's time to think about these issues. So the conference we organized in Pasteur was called Towards the Learning Planet. Okay. And so by the learning planet, we mean, you know, you probably all know about learners and about learning how to learn and about learning organization, learning collectives. A learning planet is a planet where when someone learned, someone else can learn more easily because the first one have documented their learning. Okay, so that can happen in one school, in one class. It can also happen throughout the world, as we just saw with Helen Keller and Louis Braille. And so a learning planet is this planet where we can make the learning of one contribute to the learning of others. So rather than being competing for learning, you can cooperate on building new innovations and sharing them. Okay? And so Louis Braille is certainly one of those. But today with digital tools, this can happen much faster. And basically anyone can contribute. So that's the sort of hope, dream, vision that we are trying to push for. And so there is quite a few consequences of, you know, how could we reorganize the system so that this would become possible. So I love this image. You know, Helen Keller was saying that the only thing that is worse than losing sight is not having vision. Okay, and I think that, you know, we all suffer from this sorts of paradigm, which is, you know, the fact that we are blocked behind doors that, you know, if only we could see or block, we could get around it. But and I don't know how many thousands of blocks I have in my brain, but I only know of those that I managed to overcome. Okay? But if we manage collectively to discuss, maybe we can share the blocks that we manage to overcome and we can progress faster in this. And so that's one of the things I like. Another paradigm I like is this one. I don't know if you all know this elephant story with the six blind men. Should I tell it to, is there anyone that doesn't know it? No? Okay. Okay. So it's good. No, you have to be able to say that you don't know. Okay. I think that's one of the key is knowing that you don't know. Okay. Socrates already knew this. That's a very important dimension. So this is an Indian story. And you've got these six blind men. Okay, and it's not that I have anything against blind men, as I just trying to say before. Okay. So you've got these six blind men, and they are all exploring the same thing, but they all have a very different perspective. So the one that held the trunk believes it's a snake. The one that see the leg believes it's a tree, and so on. Okay, and they all have a very different picture, and they cannot agree, of course. Okay, and they're about to fight, and so on. Okay, so in any complex reality, we all have our own vision of it, and we're all convinced that you know we are right, and everybody else must be wrong. Okay, and so if only we were able to discuss a little more, maybe we can get a more comprehensive picture, and then maybe we can find innovative solution that we could not see from each singular perspective. Okay, and you could say that you know the different disciplines are very good at looking very closely at one part of the elephant, but sometimes they are missing another part of the elephant. So we need this integrative, systemic perspective. Okay. So what about lifelong learning and more contemporary issues? So I took two covers of The Economist that basically say that AI, robotics, and so on are going to disrupt so many jobs that the only way out is lifelong learning. And one of the things that you can see on this graph is, I'm sorry, it's a little small. So it's from 1870 to today, numbers of years that people have spent learning on average. And you've got curves for Colombia, South Korea, Tunisia, and United Kingdom. Korea is the red one, it's the highest one now. But you can basically see that every 10 years, we've added 1 year on average of learning. Okay, so that's somewhat good, but if there is an acceleration, an exponential acceleration of the challenges that are coming with AI and robotics, that's probably not going to be enough. So we have to improve not only the quantity, but also the quality. Okay, so we have to consider this, and we have to be able to learn to learn and to be lifelong learners, and so we have to try to see how we can do this and where should we invest the most. And so economists like Heckman, who is a Nobel Prize winner in economy, have made this little graph, which where you've got age on one case and the return on investment. Okay, so you know educators not always want to think about returns on investment. Economists love to do this exercise. What's interesting here is that preschool program is one of the places where we invest the least, even though it's one of the places where there is the highest return on investment. So typically in France, the people that are training in preschools, that are in charge of the babies, have the lowest salary and the lowest education, and there is no research. So you know, before they can do the best possible, we are very far from this. So it's not that schools are perfect or that you know research on education is perfect, but preschool programs are even behind, even though, in fact, according to this economist, it should be one priority. And interestingly, during this mission, I met many people, including the Direction General of Treasure. They want to invest in these things. So it's interesting, you know, because they know that in this society we are not sustainable if we have so much inequalities, and investing in preschool programs is one of the way out. So this is a slide I love, and there is research done in Berkeley by Alison Gopnik that shows that we're all born scientists. And so, you know, babies can make observation, they can make hypotheses, perform experiments, analyze data, report their findings, and share and invite others to reproduce the result. Okay, and that's you know more or less what we do as scientists. We don't have exactly the same rituals. We believe we have better methodologies. Maybe we do. I don't know. But you know there is this ingrained ability that we all have, and the question is how can we build on this? Okay, so one of the things that I won't have time to discuss a lot today is was based basically on this, and something that some of or British friends may know, you know, may know Bolotto and the paper that was published with 8 years old in the primary school. So the youngest orders of scientific publications are 8 years old in Blackaton Primary School. And so when I simultaneously more or less read about this children, baby, scientist, and this authors of scientific papers at 8 years old, we launched a program that is basically a kid scientist program where we invite children to question the world and we invite scientists to help them with methodologies that can help them be ever more precise and ever more efficient in asking questions and looking for answers. But so if we're all born scientists, that's even obviously true of babies, but that's true of any one of us, not only those that are seeing themselves as professional scientists, but also to anyone else. So we are in this world where knowledge also is undergoing some transition. Okay, so we used to need to be only in the same physical space to be able to learn from one another and to acquire knowledge. In order to create knowledge, we had to be physically in one lab, and so that there were a few of them. And so, you know, we hyper-concentrated these things in universities. Universities progressively gained the power to deliver, acknowledge the knowledge acquired, and this was very local. Okay, I mean, the circles are somewhat misleading. It's very, very tiny pockets of knowledge institution. But today in the digital world, we can access knowledge anywhere. Anyone can contribute to do things. Basically, you know, this is a scientific instrument. I could show you all sorts of evidence where you can get data from it. You can share data. You can analyze data. You can do all sorts of things. That's, you know, here there is more computing power than the NASA used to go to the moon. Okay, very few people know this, and very few people, you know, dream of going to the moon with something like this. But in fact, you can conquer your own moon. It's just, you know, a matter of challenge that you set to yourself. And of course, there is new ways of certifying knowledge. Okay, the classical ones still exist, but there is emerging ones that appear in more and more professions. And so we basically have this knowledge planet, and we have all sorts of feedback that can help us to go much faster. And benefit from each other's expertise, and that's typically, you know, what this type of conference is about sharing this. But we can do this through MOOC, we can do this through all sorts of digital ways that can help scale these things. One of the things that, at least in France, we don't do well, and I don't know for other countries, is to involve the younger learners in defining what it is to learn in the 21st century. Even though, you know, it's clearly different from learning in the 20th century, but, you know, for some reason, 20th century learners tend to impose their views on 21st century learners. And so this is a poll. Sorry, it's the only slide I have in French, where, you know, and polls are not necessarily the best tool, but, you know, I don't know of better tools. So if you know of better tools, I'm quite interested in seeing better data. But French youth, 15 to 30 years old, was invited to discuss, to answer the question, whether they believe that the French education system needed to be reformed. 95% said yes. Okay, so unfortunately, no one asked them what else they want. You know, so in which direction should we reform? I don't know if they will all agree on the same, because that's always complicated, or whether they would agree with the oldest one. But at least, you know, maybe something can be done by involving them more in the decision process. So this is, of course, the old Greek saying and a sort of modern artistic perspective on this. But we all have different faces, and, you know, we discover some facets of ourselves on a regular basis. But we, you know, meiotics, I mean, the Socratic method, you know, is inspired from birth delivery. And the way birth delivery has improved since Socrates' mother is quite significant. I guess, you know, all women here would acknowledge this. But the way we get to know ourselves, does it really improve? Did it really improve since Socrates? I'm not so sure. So, you know, can we have new ways of getting to know ourselves? Can we have maybe digital mirrors? Can they help us to know who we are and what we want to do? So I think there is all sorts of basic question that we can ask like this. One of the other thing that I like as a sort of an image is, you know, science is basically based on documenting and sharing. And you probably all know the Newton or Pascal sentence on, if you want to see far, you have to climb on the shoulders of giants. Okay, so here you have a boy that climbed on the shoulders of Einstein to illustrate this. But any one of us, whenever we're exploring, you know, like Louis Braille, you know, he documented his finding and he shared them. First, it was prohibited for him to share, but he did it nevertheless at night when the adults were sleeping. You know, they shared among the in the dormitories among blind kids, and that's the way it spread. Okay, so documenting and sharing is very important for any innovation to have a real-world impact. But we tend to neglect this, especially in the education settings where there is hardly any incentive for an innovative teachers to document what they do and share it. For instance, you know, this week we gave, I mean, the minister gave several awards to innovative teachers, but, you know, there is still no MOOC, for instance, on trying to describe why are those schools special and how can others, you know, not copy them, but, you know, be inspired and develop their own solutions to their own issues. So I think that's quite important, and we have to think more about this, and we have to create incentives for these things. And we have to try to create learning organizations where, you know, and that's true at in all sorts of organizations, you know, public, private organization, NGO, all sorts of collectives can become learning ones. So I'll try to give you some example of what it could look like in some cases. So for instance, universities. Universities are supposed to be a place where we learn, but are they learning? Are university progressing when, you know, students fail or succeed? Does it change the probability that the next generation will progress or not? Okay, and the last time we did a big reform university was led by this man called Humboldt, and he was saying something that was quite visionary and only few people are truly doing, but he was saying that the university teacher is not just a teacher and a student just a pupil, but he wanted the students to conduct research and the professor to be a mentor and support him. And I think that, you know, MIT does it, you know, we try to do it in Paris, some people try to do it, but it's not yet general. Okay. Another thing you were saying, which I think is quite key, is that university should be a place where we're free to learn, free to teach, free to do research, and we have this ability to find mentors. And if that's true, interestingly, the web is a place where we are free to learn and free to teach, and to some extent free to do research, as I'll try to highlight later. So what in the age of the web, how can we reinvent the universities? And how can we make them learning universities where, you know, every time students succeed, other students are more likely to succeed? Instead of having students to compete with one another, can they cooperate to create new knowledge to go for real-world challenge such as the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals or any sorts of global or local challenge that they might be interested in? So that's the sort of things we are at least trying to prototype, and I know quite a few examples of challenge-based universities. There was a recent article last year in The Economist about this. So I think it's a new trend, but clearly it's not yet a dominant one. What's interesting is that this can be happening at all sorts of scale. So you can create a learning school. So I don't know if you know this Ali Baba. Already the name is easy to remember. And CNN and the BBC made reports on this guy, and I had the pleasure to invite him once in Paris. And when he was 8, his family was just rich enough to send him to school. But his little friends in the neighborhood, not all of them were that lucky. So when he came back, they started to ask him, what did you learn? And what he did in the afternoon is he told them what he did. And the day after, he did the same, and again and again. And when he turned 15, he had 1,000 learners in his school. Okay, and so he was the youngest principal, and that's, you can see, you know, his school is, you know, in the open, okay, in the backyard of his family house. So this is, you know, a poor village in India, but so, you know, you can create learning cascade and learning schools where, because one learned, the others can learn because they can share. Okay, so this can be done in India, it can be done anywhere, but it's just a matter of, you know, a will to do it or not. And you can do this at the level of a classroom. I mentioned briefly this children scientist program we launched. It was launched in that very class by Ange Ansour. This was her class. And you can see the adults that you can see, some of them are researchers that came to help the children design their own experiments and perform them. And this was started only 5 years ago now, but today, 8,000 teachers were trained in these methodologies, and we have hundreds of scientists that contribute to mentor one class. Maybe a few days in the year is enough to make a big difference in turning the classroom into a research laboratory where the children can ask their own questions and their own creativity, and they can learn how to cooperate with the ethics, they can learn to document themselves, they can learn to share what they've done, they learn to publish, and suddenly all sorts of things like reading, writing, and others become very meaningful because it's all about sharing knowledge and co-constructing it. So you know, as in many reports, we were invited to do proposals, so we tried to make about 10 of them. I don't know, there is something about 10 as a magic number. So the first one is to have more self-reflection and train people to do that. And so, you know, this is true for every one of us, including the teachers and all the professionals in education at all the ages of the learning society. But, you know, the idea is that if authority, hierarchical authority, is not the one to make a difference anymore, because most people cannot stand it anymore, what's authority be based upon? Okay, and can it be based upon research? Because research is a methodology that can contribute to find common answers. And so that's what we are trying to believe in. And so the LOI in here is one example where this progress, professional and personal development, can be done through research support. So that's one of the proposals. The second one is to encourage teams because, you know, research is better done in teams, and if you're alone, it's very hard. I don't know if, you know, I could have ever been a researcher if I had been on my own completely. And so we, you know, it's important to have a faculty mentor. It's important to have other mentor, other students that help you, and lab mates, and so on. And we need all sorts of things like this. You know, very much. I mean, we accept this in sports. It should be true in a research environment such as schools and certainly labs. And we have to mobilize all sorts of disciplines. I was trying with the elephant example to show that, you know, of course education science are key, but, you know, cognitive science are probably something to say. Digital science are, you know, creating all sorts of new possibilities. And so there is all sorts of dimensions that can be brought in. You know, I come from evolutionary systems biology, complex systems, and that's, you know, one of my way to look at this problem is to use some of the disciplinary tools that I grew up with in trying to analyze this. But I think, you know, every single discipline can come and bring something to these things. And so, but of course that means having more funding and more resource to do these things, and that's what is not completely there yet. One of the things we're acknowledging is that we could, for instance, create an international chair, invite some of you, invite experts from Singapore, from Finland, from Denmark, from Canada, from, you know, to come here and help us understand, you know, how did their country become involved in a continuous improvement of the education system. And so it's not to copy their solutions, but to be inspired by their past. And so there is all sorts of third places we can build, but typically places where children, adults, learners, teachers, professionals, researchers, parents, you know, everyone can come in and co-design the future of learning. And so I think we need such places. We can certainly build some of them in schools, some of them maybe in communities. You can transform libraries. We can build some of them in universities that might have a slightly different perspective. We need also digital third places. Many of the current third places that we use for learning were not designed for learning. They were designed to make money for most of them. And so, you know, if we were designing learning digital spaces where we could document and share our knowledge, what would they look like? Okay, and maybe we have to think of this. You know, can we build a sort of Socratic technologies in a way where we can collectively raise ideas and create them and share them and develop them. Can we also have a sort of a lifelong learning portfolio and record? So to give you an example, in French we have something we call the carnet de santé, so the health record. From birth on, and even before birth, we have all sorts of things that are digitalized and that are helping doctors and patients to progress. We don't have the equivalent for learning. Why not? Okay. Of course, there is also a privacy issue. Okay. But for health, which is quite private, we have that. So why don't we have this for learning? And if we had, what we would do with it? You know, can it help us to reflect upon our own trajectories and try to understand where we are? And maybe try to understand, because if many of us create this and we manage to find ways of sharing the information without, while addressing the privacy issue, which is technically possible, then we could build knowledge map. Okay, and they might look somewhat like this mountains map, and you could see, you know, where you've been, but also which valley you have not yet explored, and you know what is the path towards this new valley. Okay, and is it possible maybe to explore new heights, and maybe there's a new job opportunity there, but you know what's the shortest path from where you are to that job, and you know is there someone that already did that transition, and can you be inspired by this, and can you learn from this and go somewhere. And so you could build all sorts of service, like you know this Google Map for knowledge that can give you the time that it takes to go there. It recommends you all sorts of things that may be better suited for you. You can find, I don't know if you know in English, in French we have a company called BlaBlaCar that becomes international. So you could have a BlaBlaCar for co-traveling. Okay. So if someone else wants to travel in the same direction you want, maybe you can not travel alone in this knowledge space, but you can find an ID mate and travel together. You can maybe find a mentor in this sort of maps, and you can use that. So those are possibilities we would like to see happen. One of the key things would be to have standards and ways to develop confidence. You know, France is called the mistrust society. Okay, there is a book about us that says that we trust each other, or institutions, or politicians, decision makers, and so on. We are at the level of Russia and Turkey. Okay, so that can tell you a lot about France when you know about this. So we need to build standards also. But you know, for instance, in Lego, if you have right standards, then you can pile them up. Because they are compatible with one another. So we have to build these standards, and then it can become a child play to be able to use it, because they suddenly become hidden. But initially, they have to be very well sort of. So, I mean, we need to have places where we are thinking about these things, nationally and internationally, and that we can agree on these sorts of standards, and we have to respect the privacy. So in France, we have something called the CNIL, which is in charge of our own data and privacy. Okay, so clearly we started to discuss with them about these issues, and of course they are very sensitive issues. But you know they encourage us to say that if there is clear benefit for people, then that might be important, because at the moment it's not like we are not leaving any digital traces. We are leaving lots of digital traces, but so far they're being used for commercial purposes mostly. Okay, or surveillance, or you know, so-called intelligence, which you know, I'm not very sure I have the same definition of intelligence. So I think we have all sorts of issues here. And so we have to build these things, and we have to build an ethical framework for this. And so I like this picture of Aristotle, because it helps me remind myself that there's, according to him, three forms of knowledge. Episteme, which is knowing the world, that gave epistemology and science; techne, which is acting upon the world, which gave technology, and that grew exponentially, clearly since Aristotle's time; and phronesis. I don't know how many people know what phronesis is in the room. Okay, and that's one of the problem is that because phronesis is the third pillar of knowledge, and it's the ethics of action. Okay, and so we have a lot of science and a lot of technology, but we are not putting the ethics. We've not developed ethics as much. And I think we really have to address this. Okay, and so even in research, I mean, in health research, there is a lot of ethical issues that have been debated for long. But in terms of education, I think there is probably similar debates that should be started or amplified, especially with all the issues I was discussing. And so we have to create also learning territories, and they have to be somewhat fractal. Okay, so there is the territories, maybe even the family. I mean, the individual, the family, the community, the city, the region, the country, the planet, and we have you know physical communities and digital communities, and all this play important roles. And so, how can we make sure that, again, every time a learner makes some progress, another learner can make it more easily because there is a way to share and document all this and leave trails that facilitate others' learners' journey. The last proposal, which if we're lucky, should be announced quickly, is to build a sort of a research alliance. Because in France, we have research alliance for health. We have some for energy, environment, humanities, but we don't have anyone for education. And in fact, the research funding for education, I don't know how it is in your countries, but in France, it's disappointedly small. You know, health and education are about the same in the global national budget in France, but the research on health is about 30 times the research on education. And I try to understand why. You know, I come from biomedical research, so I'm the lucky one, and I'm moving into this new field, and I say, how come there is no funding? I mean, it can't be. This is so important, especially in this digital age where everything is changing so fast and the jobs are going to change and so on. We definitely have to invest much more. But we also have to structure ourselves. And so a research alliance might be a place where all sorts of existing research institutions and maybe upcoming ones will come together and will work to address some of the issues I was trying to highlight today, and many more that you know about or that will be emerging sooner or later. Of course, there is a cost for these things. So I use someone that with the power of Barack Obama to try to support what I was trying to say. Of course, you have to invest in these things, but not investing in it, I think, is no longer an option. And so I think that's one of the key issue that hopefully can be discussed with people that have the power to open the tap, which is obviously complicated. But what's interesting is maybe social impact bonds. There is all sort of new innovative funding system, because we have such a cost of kids dropping out of schools, of unemployment, and so on. If we were to invest wisely early enough, we can probably avoid all sorts of sunk costs of today. And so investing in this would be a sort of a future investment that we can try to decide. I think we have to be imaginative in terms of communities of practice that we have, and coming from health and coming from other dimensions of research, I'm very keen on what's called citizen science or participatory research. And there was last week signed an agreement at the national level here where Ministry of Research, research organization, NGOs came together and say, yes, we can do citizen science together. We have to respect a charter, but there is lots of things that can be done. And it already exists for health, for biodiversity, for climate, for galaxies, for even mathematics. I mean, very subjects that are not so easy for the average citizen. But for some reason, I don't know in France, but I know in France, but I don't know if you know in other places. I don't know if citizen science project on learning. Okay. Whereas, if there is something which we could all contribute, is to say, what it is that we learn, what it is that we cannot learn, and we could pretty easily document this, and that can help us tremendously. So I have a good friend that happens to be a Nobel Prize winner in medicine, is about to launch such a participatory research project in the US. And I think we can invent many others, and we can build platforms that can allow many more people to ask questions such as, if 95% of the kids are not happy with the current system, what else would they want? So we can do participatory research on these sorts of subjects and involve every citizens, teachers, and parents, and so on. So of course, it would be better if we had international collaboration for all this, because research that is helping Scotland to progress can help other countries and as people, we here we have some international colleagues. In the Pasteur Institute, I had people from Finland, from Singapore, from Switzerland, from Ireland, from the US, from Haiti, and so on. And it was really interesting to share this perspective. And so building this learning planet can be done much more easily, because we have air travel, we have digital tools, we have all sorts of ways of sharing, and many of the questions that we discuss. Of course, if a single country trying to invest a lot to solve on its own, it might be too much. But if we have open R&D on these subjects, we can go much further, and we can fulfill some of the ideas of the United Nations, because you probably know these sustainable developmental goals 17 priorities that the United Nations decided. The number four is quality lifelong learning for all. Okay. So how can we build an open R&D around this subject, and can we invite everyone, any citizen on the planet, to contribute to be as innovative as WeBraille was? You know? So can we try to foster the next generations of WeBraille and all be involved in that global network? Thank you.
Thank you. Some questions, remarks, comments? It's up to you.
Thank you. That was a great presentation. Thank you. So I was wondering, the 10 propositions, are they equally as important, or, you know, if you were going to have to select three, or, you know, if there was a priority of any of them, you know, are there some that are more important than others, I guess?
I mean, it's a good point. I think that all of them are interesting one by one, and we could prioritize a couple or more. But I think that if we do them together, then we can have a systemic change. Okay, and my feeling is that what's truly needed is a systemic change. Okay, some sort of coordinated plan towards change that will include these 10 and probably quite a few others, but I think we need something like this. When we did this exercise, we interviewed hundreds of people. Olivier, you know, invited thousands of participants to join a digital platform we built, where we got more than 1,200 contributions. We got, you know, thousands of people visiting, and so we tried to, when we organized this pastor conference, after I gave a somewhat similar talk, we invited 300 people that were there to react and build new proposals. Okay, and they built new proposals and they refined some of them and so on. And then they presented it to our international friends that starting to tell them, well, that you believe might be hard. Well, you know, in our country it works. You know, so we encourage you to go further. And in other cases, saying, well, you know, that not so sure. Maybe it's more complex than what you think, and you know, there is this sort of side effect that you have to be at least aware of. And so it was very interesting to have an open dialogue around this. So we really try, I mean, it's so huge to cover that we really try to mobilize the collective intelligence to think about the best way to mobilize the collective intelligence in the future, if you want. Okay, so I think if there was only one proposal, would be to ideally change the culture. Okay, and help everyone to see themselves as change makers and as researchers and as a contributing to this learning planet. Okay, if we had only that single change, then I think everything else would become much easier. And so, you know, we made sort of semi-formal proposals for the government, but we also tried to end the report with proposals for every citizen, every actor. Okay, if you're a teacher, what can you do in your class? If you're, you know, a university president, what can you do? If you are, you know, a parent, you know, and so on. And I think we can, each of us can do a lot. And I think it's not exactly the same advice for a minister and a student, but it's somewhat the same spirit. It's, you know, question, be yourself, explore. Link with others, share, co-create. You know, those are very simple things to say. I mean, they're somewhat harder to put in place, especially if you are in an institutions where, you know, there's all sorts of incentive for you not to do these things. Okay, I don't know how it is in your institutions, but as academics, we have incentives to publish. We have hardly any incentive to take care of our students. Okay, so for instance, in this country, the concept of scholarship of teaching and learning is not even part of the radar. Okay, so faculty here, you know, we call them enseignant-chercheurs, teaching researcher, but, you know, they see teaching as a duty and research as a freedom. I mean, you know, when you start like this, it's already a very bad start. But if you tell them that they can research in their classroom, that they can start, you know, questioning the way they teach, they can start questioning their students, they can involve their students in being more reflective. There is all sorts of things that can be done and can be shared. And so that's the sort of things we're trying to promote, is to see everyone slightly differently. Okay, and this reflexivity, this ability to question, to research, to experiment with, if we are born with it, you know, what can we do to make it grow rather than, if not suppress it, at least not develop it as much as we can. Tim?
Thank you very much. It seems to me that a lot of the things that you suggest would be would come into effect much more easily if there were freedom. You talked about freedom quite a lot, actually. The trouble is, most policymakers are really scared of freedom. What they want is control. So how do you create this in a context where there's a desire for control and ever more? Well, you talked about surveillance as well, because we're in a culture where we've got a lot of fear in our culture. If somebody drives into a crowd of people in London and kills four, that's on a scale unimaginably worse than the numbers of people dying in Africa every day, for our media, and that's because they want us to be very afraid. So how do you solve those bigger problems of control and fear and surveillance to enable these things to happen?
And that's probably the key to key question for the future of our democracy and living rights and freedom. I don't have a magic wand, okay? So I'm not going to give you the answer to the very good question that you have. What I can say is, since Athens in the old time, democracy, education, exchange of ideas, science have co-evolved. Then, you know, French Revolution, Enlightenment, you know, was again this notion of freedom, you know. So here we say liberté, égalité, fraternité, okay. So at least in theory, we put this in front of every school. Then in practice, do we give as much freedom and equality and fraternity as we could in these schools? That's probably, there is a room for improvement. But to some extent, I think what we need to build is what I define sometimes as frame of freedom. Okay, and people tell me that, you know, this is an oxymoron, and I met some lawyers that told me that, you know, the l'état de droit, the I don't know how you say this in English, the rule of law. Yes, thank you. The rule of law is a frame of freedom. Okay, we have a frame. Okay. And that gives us some freedom, but for instance, the freedom to kill is not part of our freedom that within that frame. And it's an evolving frame of freedom. Okay. So what I try to do, for instance, with my students, we started our center around a table that big, and for some reason it doubled every 18 months in the last 15 years. So now it's pretty big. And we build it as an evolving frame of freedom, where we give a frame of freedom to students, we let them explore what they wanted, and we were there to help them. So we were very Humboldtian. In this freedom to learn, freedom to teach, freedom to do research. And, you know, we are going that far now that we are launching what we call a white diploma. Okay? So a white diploma is like a white call for research. Okay? It's something that is white to begin with, but it's not white at the end. Okay? And it's their responsibility to write something useful on their diploma, because this is going to be their portfolio that are going to show to their future employers, to the future university that might want them, or to their mother-in-law or whoever. Okay, and I think we need to do these sorts of things. Okay, so we give this freedom because the future is so unpredictable that if we're trying to control people, we lose enormous amount of energy and creativity. So interestingly, of course, you know, you could say Socrates was already saying this. To a large extent, okay, and Maria Montessori and Freinet and so many others. And so the question is whether it's more needed today than yesterday. Because as an evolutionary biologist, I know that you can have a given genome, there is no perfect genome, it's always more or less adapted to an environment. So of course there is a coevolution between, you know, our environments that is selecting for this type of behavior or that type of behavior and or individual action. And so that's what we have to work on. Okay. And I think we have to give the freedom to think about the possible future. Okay. Some people in Silicon Valley are trying to sell us a singularity as our common future. Okay. Well, why can't we invent the plurality of futures? Okay. Can we invite the next generations to invent their own path towards the future rather than forcing them to, you know, follow whatever stupid orders and compete and so on. So instead of competing with one another, can they cooperate to build tomorrow? Because today they are competing on yesterday's knowledge. Can we invite them to cooperate on tomorrow's solution? That's at least a take-home message that every one of us as citizens can take for themselves and, you know, try to convey to the next generation and try to see what they do with it. but whether they will win, I don't know. Socrates lost, but I'm hopeful.
You made a lot of parallels between health sciences and education in terms of funding. Do you think that, and you said that in health sciences, this evidence-based practice, it's working. What do you think that could be the, I don't know, the three main points we can inspire from health sciences in education, as educators?
So I think that we, in medicine, we care about every patient.
Okay? And in education?
I let you know education better than me. Okay, so I let you answer that one. Okay, so that's one point. We invest in research, and we involve patients in the research design. Okay, and also doctors, and we involve many different disciplines. Okay, and we put resource. Okay, so I mean, if we were doing this, typically, you know, France has one of the, according to WHO, best medical system. Okay, and that medical system is a combination of medical system, research for medicine, and training for medicine. Mm-hmm. Okay, and also good policies. Okay, and all of this is informed by research. You know, for me, it's sort of obvious this is the way to go. Okay, so why don't we have this for education? I don't know. Okay, I'm the only thing I'm somewhat good at is at questioning. You know, so I questioned the Minister of Education a year ago, like, you know, what is the R&D budget for education? And she couldn't give me an answer. No one in the ministry could give me an answer. So that's why I was invited to do this session. Okay, it's because I questioned. Okay, and I think that's the first point. We have to start questioning. Okay, why is the system like it is? Why can't it change? You know, and we can be inspired by other countries that have changed. We can be inspired by other fields that have changed. We can be inspired by the way at which the digital communities are evolving so fast. We can be inspired by many things. You know, I'm inspired by bacteria and ants and all sorts of things that are able to cooperate and be self-organized and be super efficient and evolve in a very efficient way. Okay, I work on the evolution of error rates. When the world is changing faster, you have to accept more errors. Okay, so, you know, can we have a culture that is promoting not necessarily errors, but at least the fact that, you know, it's okay to have errors, especially if we can learn something from our mistakes. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can learn from all sorts of places. And health is one of them, and I would say biology and any evolving system. Okay, because I think one of the take-home message from what I learned from bacteria come from actually Lewis Carroll has understood it on his own way, same time as Darwin, you know, with the image of the Red Queen. The Red Queen was running very fast with Alice, but they didn't move. And so Alice is wondering, why don't we move? And the Queen says, in this country, you have to run as fast as you can to stay in place. And if you want to get somewhere else, you have to run faster. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so in any country where the world is changing fast, if you're not changing as fast as the other, you're going to be obsolete sooner or later. Okay? So it's not that schools are not changing, but they are not exactly keeping up with the pace of society and technologies. And so we need to find ways of speeding up, one way or the other. And then we have to question which direction we want to run. Okay? Because catching up with robots, it's not going to be the most interesting. Maybe we want to run in a complementary way. Maybe we want to be able to... I mean, I think the more machines can do, the more we have to question ourselves as humans, what it is to be human. Okay? And what's specific about our intelligence compared to artificial intelligence. And maybe we should nurture that part of the intelligence in us and in our children. So memorizing and computing, sorry, but machines do this very, very well. Okay? So that's, if you're only good at computing and memorizing, a machine is going to replace you. I'm not saying those are useless skills, but they are not sufficient anymore. Okay. So there is all sorts of things like empathy and, you know, defining meaning is something that machines cannot do. They can optimize for something else, but they cannot define what they're optimizing for.
So you you wrote a report for a minister. What's the first advice you gave a minister to the first pace to make? What the first idea? Because all your principles are quite seducing, but what the first decision to, or two, one, maybe one, two, three, first decision? You talk about money, for instance, funding and so on, but do you have an advice to give to a minister of education?
I think that every minister is usually imposing one reform, if not many. Okay, and I think that imposing a reform is probably not the way to go. Okay, but providing the actors with the tools so that they can invent their own path is probably the key. Okay, and that's one of the key dimensions. And you can, of course, if you give them money, it's going to be easier. But already, if you give them the freedom, that might be the most relevant. Okay, and especially in the French context, the freedom of the actors is not necessarily the way they see themselves. Okay, I'll give you one example. I don't know all of the countries you're from if they still have an inspection, but Finland, Singapore, and many others have suppressed their inspection. So of course, when I talk about this with inspectors, they look at me in a strange way. But it's not that I'm against them as a person. I'm against this idea that there is someone to control you rather than to empower you and to help you grow. So, you know, if inspectors would become mentors, that would be very nice. Okay, and so I discussed with one interesting inspector, that is Inspector General, so he knows, you know, so we have N layers of inspection and control, 10 layers between the minister and the teacher. You know, I had to ask the minister to count, and she ended up with 10 different layers. Okay. And so if you have 10 layers and you have to have a yes from all 10 layers, it's not going to come. Okay. So if you inverse the logic from a control and command system to a trust and freedom, empowering people and sort of, if you really want to control a posteriori rather than a priori, I think it's a big difference. So I discussed with this Inspector General and he told me that we have to come back to the etymology of inspection. Okay. Inspectare in Latin is looking in. Okay, if you look at prospect, it's looking forward. Respect, it's looking backward. Introspect is looking within. Okay, so there is all sorts of. One of the things that is missing is cumspect, which would be looking together. Okay, and I think that, you know, looking together and inviting people to an open conversation, such as the one we're having, on not, you know, you have to do this, but, you know, what it is that we can do together to get moving and to become a learning society. I think that's the sort of open discussion I would like to have, okay? Because every minister comes with this reform and then impose everything, okay? So, for instance, one of the latest is, okay, no, you're free to be innovative. That's, but, you know, you are free. You have to be creative. I mean, that's hard. You see what I mean? So that cannot work. I mean, there is such a structure of power in this system. So that would be the number one advice.
In an existing university, what are the change you introduce in your own center, of which is a kind of, not a model, but something interesting? What kind of change did you introduce in the university? Small example of small triggers you pushed on in order to change you have a bachelor, you have a master, and all an organization, which is an example. It's why you have been chosen for this mission. It's good. Thank you. And because I share all your principles, but what did you change simply?
So the first. I talk about the white diploma, but the first diploma we created was a Master 2, a second year of Master, and still exists, and it's relatively simple. It's free internships in three laboratories of three different disciplines. The students choose. Okay, the only things we ask them is to do some experiments and some modeling, some theory, okay? Because we want them to be both able to conceptualize and to know what the real world is. Okay. And so that's a relatively simple master program, but then our students wanted to do all sorts of crazy type of PhD and not stay within the box. So basically what we did is we created a space for ugly little ducklings. For people, we created a box for those that want to be out of the box, if you want, okay? And so, you know, instead of a box, we build this frame of freedom and we evolved it because we listen to the students every year. We listen to all sorts of stakeholders that came to us and say, why don't we do this? So for instance, one of the latest stakeholders I met during the mission is people in charge of this early childhood. There is no master, there is no PhD, there is hardly any research. And I told them, yeah, well, let's work, let's discuss, let's do something. Okay. So if you have a space where we can discuss issues and we can build solutions, either from that the issue is raised by a student or by an institution that is in charge of early childhood, it doesn't matter. You know, we can come together. And so building these sorts of third spaces, open creative space where we can have an open discussion and look for common solutions, because there is all sorts of bricks, okay? I mean, like most of what I presented, solution partly exists, but you know, how do you spread them, how do you share them, how do you recombine them, how do you evolve them, how do you adapt them to your needs is one of the rate limiting steps today, okay? So can we have places where this conversation can happen? Can we have more of them? Can we have them at every scale, in every space? That's typically the question I would ask. And what's interesting is, you know, I went to Singapore, for instance, during this mission, and China, and Switzerland, and so on. And I had visited quite a few other countries before, but Singapore, two-thirds of schools, primary schools, secondary schools, have a research group in it. Okay, so they are questioning. So this idea that we're all born scientists and we can all question and we can all build a research group to address our issues, lots of health patients, to come back to your point, have self-organized and they became patient researchers. And they are very efficient. And the Medical Research Council in this country now trains the patients to become researchers' patient. Okay, so we can do the very same thing in education. So I think there is all sorts of relatively easy steps and that go from, you know, the individual to the collective. I think it's the collective intelligence that is our answer, at least it's my answer, but I think it would be our answers to the artificial intelligence debate. Okay. Because we can have many more perspectives. But if each of us is like a small little machine, we're not going to make it. Because we'll build better machines than this.
Perhaps me. Two things. When you talk about research, it seems like research is questioning the world. With manipulating knowledge and things like that. When we talk about research in the academic world, it's rather a technical thing. It's to be academic, it's to use certain methodologies, some tools and some theories and so on. And there is perhaps an ambiguous. In the use of the word research, first thing. The second thing is about you use Aristotle categories, techne, phronesis, and episteme. And in the educational debate at international level, this morning, and I think we'll talk about this later, there is a huge debate between evidence-based education, narrative review, systematic review, the nature of evidence in education. And often there is a mix with conceptions of education, of education activities, of teaching, which is often linked with the idea of if education is only something very technical, and you see the techne idea of Aristotle, of if there is something like wisdom, phronesis, or something like that. And it seems that today, at an international level, the main idea is rather a technical concept of educational activities between standards, between, and the main trend behind education-based education is rather education like something only techné without phronesis or wisdom or anything like that. Do you think something about that? Is that clear?
Yeah, I mean it's complex issues, and already there is at least two main questions that you were asking. Okay, the first one is the way academia is organized. Okay, and academia is organized around disciplines. Okay, and I think that disciplines are very useful to improve methodologies and to produce data and to refine one way to look at the world, but they should not forget that the real world doesn't know disciplines. Okay, discipline is just a social construct. Okay, and any real world issues require probably several disciplines to be understood, and even more for any improvement to happen. So I think that one of the things we have to do is go beyond this six elephants type of perspective. We have to at least learn to talk together. Okay? Our center is called Center for Research and Interdisciplinarity. So I do believe in interdisciplinarity. Okay, I did mathematics, then I did physics, then I did a PhD in biology, then I did a postdoc in evolutionary biology, then I did systems biology, and now I'm interested in education. Okay, I mean, of course I learned a lot of things from those various disciplines, but I never felt compelled to stay within one box of discipline. I basically used the disciplines as tools to move my understanding and my ability to discuss with others and try to do something, or at least to understand something. So disciplines should be tools, and we are not there to serve the disciplines. We are here to, the disciplines should be helping us, professors, researchers, students, citizens, they should be serving us, okay? And same with our tools, okay? Technologies should be there to serve us, not the opposite, okay? And I think that if we are overemphasizing, you know, technical abilities, and if you can precisely define a given technical ability and try to train and hone the skills for it, there is one big problem that you have to be aware of, that if you can define it that precisely, you can probably ask a robot to do it. Okay? So if the only thing you know is perfect skills in one technique, one day or the other, a machine will replace you. What machines cannot do is, as I was saying before, is be creative, be asking new questions. So, I mean, Google can give you all the answers. Google cannot ask any question. I mean, you already see a big difference. So today we still rate our students based on the quality of their answers. But, you know, if the answer is already present in Google, and if you can, you know, in multiple choice assess it, it means a machine can do it. Therefore, for me, it's meaningless. Okay? Why don't we rate our students based on their questions, for instance? I mean, basically, that's the way you rate a PhD, is, you know, is it a relevant question? You know, there is a famous quote in biology with Nobel Prize winner saying, not even interesting. Okay, it's correct, but not even interesting. Okay, so those are meaningless, basically. Okay, so defining meaning, I think, is what we need to do. Okay, and that's why I quote quite a lot of ancient classics and humanities and so on, because I think that during the Enlightenment, during these early periods, people were asking some of those deep questions. And I think we have to go back to these deep questions. Okay, and I think that's much more relevant than the sort of course, it's easier to compare everyone, including countries, if we all go for the very same standards. But again, if machines can do all this, that's probably meaningless.
Well, actually, my question was very related to what you just said about deep questions, because I agree with your critique and the fact that we need a change in most of our educational systems. And you're also arguing that, with, for example, Humboldt, that we need this change. So actually, you're arguing for change with old ideas, which I think is a very good and clever idea. But what I think we've seen in many educational systems and with many reforms is that we've actually forgotten the old ideas, we've forgotten Humboldt. So my question is, how do we make change while retaining these important old ideas, and so that we not, while doing these changes, so to speak, throw the baby out with the water? So I mean, how do we insist on these also important educational ideas while still making the important changes that are needed? I don't know if you get my question.
I guess, of course, that's a very good question. And I think, you know, maybe that's the main task for 21st century learner. And 20th century learner is to try to sort out what it is in this past that we really need for the 21st century. Okay, so I would argue that, you know, it's more important to understand, you know, the principles of Aristotle and Socrates than to know Greek. Of course, knowing ancient Greek is one of the ways that you can explore it further, but I don't believe that everyone should learn Latin and Greek, but I think that everyone should be invited to reflect on some of the principles that these guys were already starting to dig. And so, for instance, I don't speak German, but, you know, I still like Humboldt. And clearly, if I was speaking German, you know, maybe that would make my ability to understand Kant and Hegel and Humboldt better. But I think we have to try to see, you know, what it is and maybe to reframe it, to see why it is relevant. Okay. So, of course, there is many things of the past that are still relevant today, but I'm not sure everything of the past is relevant today. And certainly we cannot fit all of it into a child's brain. So we have to somewhat discuss together, and including with them, you know, what it is and why we believe this is relevant. And I think what I'm impressed with, for instance, I don't know if you know a philosopher program for children, philosophy program for children, but they are very, very clever program, and kids very quickly ask very deep questions. And in fact, they can, some of them can converge back to these ancient things, and then you can give it to them sort of just in time, okay? And say, you know what, this is a very good question, but by the way, you're not completely the first one to address it, so maybe you want to see what others have done. And maybe we can, I'll end with a quote from Confucius, or maybe I'll add another one later, but depending on when you tell me, Olivier, to stop. But Confucius was saying there is three ways towards wisdom. And it could be three ways towards any goal that you want. You can choose wisdom, you can choose whatever you prefer, like good teaching. The first one is to make mistake and to learn from your mistake. The second one is to think deep about the issues that you are interested in. Okay? And the third one is to imitate the wisest people around you. Okay? But what Confucius didn't say is, how do you imitate the wisest people around you? How do you identify the wisest people around you? Because typically those that claim they are the wisest are not the wisest. Okay? And people that say wisdom is easy, it's all in this book, they got it wrong. Okay? Wisdom cannot be anything but open. It cannot be a closed book with all of the definitions for the future of wisdom. Okay? So it has to be an open-ended quest. Okay? And so, you know, transferring some basic principles, whether they come from Greece, old China, or somewhere else, doesn't matter. Okay? We have to invite people in this trip. Okay? And I'll end, because I see Olivier is sort of heading towards this, with T.S. Eliot. Okay? T.S. Eliot, talking about wisdom, was saying, where is the life we've lost in living? Where is the wisdom we've lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we've lost in information? And I think today we could add, where is the information we are losing in data? Okay? And one of the key is to take this poem, discuss it with everyone, including the youngest one, and invite them to think, you know, how do we recover what we've lost in that, and invite them to think about these issues. So I think there is all sorts of ways to address this. You know, maybe they will prefer, you know, Master Yoda quote rather than Confucius quote. But, you know, as soon as it can get them to discuss and question, I think that's the most relevant. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, François.